Hello and welcome to the Sussex Founders Podcast. In this series, we get to know some of the fantastic software businesses being built in and around Brighton and Sussex. We'll talk to the founders and understand how they're building their product, their business and their team. In this episode, we're talking to Peter Ramsey, who's founder and CEO of PropTech company Movem. We'll talk to Pete about how he started Movem and how he took it through several rounds of funding and a major pivot through to a multi-million pound exit. And don't forget, Sussex Founders isn't just a series of podcasts, we've also got a series of events. So make sure you sign up at sussexfounders.com and come along to the next meetup to chat with like-minded founders. So without further ado, let's get on with the episode. Right, well, welcome to Peter Ramsey, who's founder and CEO of Movem, who are a SaaS company doing instant tenant referencing, which is actually a lot cooler than it sounds.
Yeah.
So it's great to have you here.
Thank you.
We're sat here.
Good
in
there.
Thank you. Yeah, I should kind of give a bit of a disclosure. Me and Pete have worked together in the past.
Yeah.
So I'm kind of raiding my contact book at the moment for people who we can get onto the show to come and tell us about these cool companies they've made. But I think Movem is such an interesting company because you started it at uni, like, and it kind of, it's gone on for years, and it's been hugely successful. So I think it's going to be a really interesting episode to kind of go through how you got started and, you know, up to now and the challenges and everything along the way. But yeah, great to have you here. So when you came up with this idea, like, how did you actually stumble across it? Because it didn't start out as instant referencing, did it?
No. So the original idea was more to do with like a trip advisor for housing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you can review some places, get reviews yourself, and then the idea would be like an Airbnb trip advisor. And the idea was really organic. So I was in a bad house. I had a really bad landlord. I wanted to go online and leave him a bad review to get some of my own back, probably. You know, and then there was nowhere, so I just made like a WordPress site for my own review, and then other people around the university started leaving their own. So it started really organically. There wasn't a business there. There wasn't like a model there.
And was literally the first review on the site your own?
Yeah.
Your own review.
Yeah, and then I got my housemates to review that house. So we had six reviews of the bad house. And then, yeah, I just sent it around, and, you know, university is quite a convenient place because you know lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
So had this WordPress site that I built in a couple of days, and then, yeah, sent it around. As like, if you could just leave a really basic review. And then over the next few weeks, like, I walked into the library like a few weeks later, and I remember walking through and seeing like computers on it. And I was like, this is going to be Facebook.
Yeah.
Right. Little did I know that actually outside the bubble of really pissed off students, there wasn't much there. But that's where the idea came from.
That's interesting, because there is, this is a kind of a familiar pattern that you see of startups like this kind of getting in their initial like network going through a university type scenario. So like, how did you get the first users? You were literally just advertising it around campus, word of mouth, kind of thing.
Yeah, so up to library moment, I think it went viral in a very localized way.
Mm-hmm.
So we had like, probably our biggest traffic day was in that first week. We genuinely had like 10,000 unique visitors or something over like a few weeks.
Wow.
And I think it was just because everyone, like, I sent it to all my friends and then I begged them to send it to their friends, right? But what happened was so many students had so many bad houses that they were going on also to like leave reviews, and then they were sharing it with their friends to get that. So it, like, it was quite a natural thing.
Yeah.
So we didn't do any advertising in the early days. But that was kind of, you know, after the first like few days, I decided I'd drop out of uni to pursue it, because I genuinely thought at that moment, like, this is going to be, in a month's time, this is going to be enormous.
Mm-hmm.
Getting it outside that university area was like really difficult.
Okay.
Because then you suddenly need advertising.
You're into a whole new kind of bubble.
Whereas for a while, it was kind of viral.
Mm-hmm. So when you started it, did you have any concept of how you might monetize it at that point? Or were you really kind of scratching your own itch that you just wanted this thing to exist no matter what, and you were going to kind of find out how to monetize it later?
Yeah, I think the internet was a different... Internet was a different place back then.
Yeah, like, so what, when are we talking about? When was...
This is late 2012, early 2013.
Okay.
So, I was in my last year of uni. And the internet was kind of a different place. So website page advertising was still a sustainable model.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there is a world back then where you could have had adverts on a website that made money if you had the traffic.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now I think that's quite... It's not going to happen, really.
Yeah, there's no money in advertising.
So back then, and also, like, I'd never done business before.
Mm-hmm.
I'd done my own website stuff. So in my head, I didn't really think about it. It was just, I'll sell advertising, people will buy it.
Mm-hmm.
And to be fair, they did. So after it went local and people were moaning about their landlords, we had like most of the reviews, if not all of them, were negative. And to me, I was like, it was kind of like stick it to the man. It was like, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah.
Because we'll just sell advertising.
Mm.
So we don't need the landlords to like it. Everyone will moan and then it'll just work out. And then nightclubs paid to advertise. So within like a few months, we had this nightclub. They're paying £500 a month to have this advert on there.
Wow. So you're kind of doing your own direct deals. You weren't necessarily just installing Google AdWords, or you're actually going out there and getting local companies on board.
Yeah, we were. And that was what I thought would work. The clubs didn't get anything out of it in the end, so they all pulled out after a few months. But the business model never felt like a problem at the beginning.
No, I guess if you've got a lot of users coming in a very localized area, you can find ways to monetize that in one way or another.
Well, that was it. And there was a million ideas of things we could do if we kept the traffic.
Mm.
That was the thing that I knew we had to do, was like keep building that traffic. As I say, that was our biggest day, implying it went downhill from there, which is, I think, what happened. I don't think we ever matched that.
But at a certain stage, didn't you? But I think it would be interesting to focus on that first phase for just a little bit longer, because it would be... So you built the very first version essentially is a WordPress site, right?
Yeah.
And you built that yourself?
Yeah.
And how long were you working on it on your own before you started getting other people involved?
So what happened was, I was building the WordPress site for probably 6 months on my own.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, WordPress... The building and WordPress is probably the wrong word. Configuring themes.
Yeah, like, a surprising amount of companies have started with a hacked WordPress site. It's like
I've done website stuff before, but I wasn't building in the same way that the Moving guys later built stuff.
Yeah, but it's still putting it together.
Yeah, so what I did is configure stuff, and then when new features came around, I had these two guys in India.
Mm-hmm.
That I found on Fiverr or People Per Hour or
something. Yes,
like that. And I got them just to build functionality. And they built these plugins that broke all the time.
Yeah.
Like, it was terrible code, but they got the functionality. There was like a search box that I couldn't find. Like, it couldn't search by the parameters I wanted.
Okay.
So I'd pay them like £500 and they'd build the thing.
Okay.
So
keeping it kind of super lean and just getting in basically freelance help along the way to make that essentially MVP phase still then, isn't it?
Because I was bootstrapping at that point, so every penny was my own money.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any money.
Yeah.
So to pay £500 was like I'd save for a month to get the search in.
And so like the good thing about that is like you're super confident that that's something that people wanted at that time, as you were like, you're not just throwing around investment money or whatever. You've like, actually, this is a big chunk to me at that time.
It's a big commitment. Which is probably, so I did that for, I don't know, 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt like a long time. And I think we'd naturally gone to three unis because I was like, we need more unis. Tried Southampton, that was Bournemouth, tried Southampton and Brighton, and they just like flopped immediately.
Mm-hmm.
Reason being is I couldn't get the same network effect there. I'd send it to like random people in Southampton and it would just die. Like, it didn't have the same everyone using it effect, so it was really difficult.
You did some kind of growth hacky stuff, didn't you, to get some of those initial users on to write reviews. I think you did like some competitions and stuff like that.
Yeah, loads of stuff like that. We actually ended up buying two competitors.
Oh, okay.
So two people that built review databases. We bought them for like, I think one was like £1,000, one was like £500. So it was like acquisition of the
to give you a bit of a kickstart in those new markets.
Yeah, so just bought some reviews and then did things like win a bottle of vodka if you leave a review, things like that.
Nice.
I wouldn't say any of them ever worked well. Like the cost per acquisition was still probably £1, £2 per review.
Yeah.
So I wouldn't say that's great.
No.
But it kept things moving along. And then, yeah, after 2 years, we kind of raised our first seed round.
So this is one of the more interesting phases that you're going to go into here, because, you know, these days we see loads of companies crowdfunding on Crowdcube, but you were one of the first to kind of really embrace that, and actually one of the few exits that they've ever had.
Yeah.
So like this is a really interesting phase. Like, so why did you go into crowdfunding? Like, what made you do that, and how did you put your pitch together?
Yeah. Well, the crowdfunding was the second and third rounds.
Mm-hmm.
The first one we had a seed round.
Okay.
Some angel investors, and then we spent all that money.
Yeah.
And we didn't really make the progress we wanted. We're in like 90 cities, but like we still haven't had a business model. No one was paying for advertising. None of the marketing was working in any meaningful way. We had a team of like 15 people at one point.
Wow.
And we just spent money too quick. Never came in. I had to move back to Brighton to live with my mum and dad.
Mm-hmm.
Got rid of everybody. Literally had zero in the bank. And then, then we crowdfunded. So that was a year after the first round. I'd say that year was just a year of just like constant mistakes, of just like everything was wrong.
So you're in the kind of the valley of death of startups at that point. So you've raised your first money and the traction's not been quite enough. So you've massively downsized.
Yeah.
And then you're thinking, right, what can I do next? How can we get this back on the road?
Yeah, and then we had debts of legal fees and stuff. And so, the crowdfunding was interesting. So we used Crowdcube both times. Crowdfunding is a topic of its own. So I don't know how much...
I think this is a really interesting area to explore, because a lot of people may be kind of considering it, but there's a lot of stuff that you might not realise that comes with crowdfunding, like keeping thousands of investors up to date with what you're doing and all that kind of stuff. So it'd be interesting to talk a little bit about your experience with it.
So crowdfunding, to start with, you don't raise the full amount on the crowdfunding platforms. Mm-hmm. That's like a lie that they peddle. So when you see someone, even like Monzo, right, when you see they raise £1 million, they've probably got 600,000 of it in the bag from industrial, you know, institutional investors, right, or angels. So that's what we did. So I went around pitching for months to try and get the initial money in. And at this point, I'm living at home. You know, we don't have a team. Development is zero. Progress is very slow. You know, people are still signing up. We're maybe getting a review a day, but, you know, no one's buying anything. So my pitch is really, look, we made a bunch of mistakes. This is kind of where I think we can take it. We're going to change the model slightly, whatever. Went around pitching for a few months, found a few investors. I think for the first round, we wanted 200,000. And I had 80,000 already committed.
Mm-hmm.
And what that means is some investors were saying, we'll give you 80,000 at valuation of X.
If you match it.
If you find the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So then I went to crowdfunding for the rest. It's an odd one. So, pre-pitch, there's loads of work to do.
Yeah.
So I lined up I knew the campaign was going to be 4 weeks. I don't even know if they're time limited now, because seeders don't time limit them, I don't think.
Some of them seem to kind of be never ending as well, with this overfunding that goes into the hundreds of percent.
Yeah. Well, that's the decision. Do you overfund? You have to choose up front if you overfund or not, or at least you did. And I said, we don't want to overfund because I don't want to give away more percent, because I've lost a big chunk from the last round that I wasted.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I want to have some of this company left at the end. So you had the money up front. For the other bit, I didn't get the cash early on, So I still had zero money to spend on marketing. So I did the video myself. I borrowed a camera. I rented a camera, it was like £200. And then I went to Brighton Uni with a mate who was studying there. And he let me in the library. And I sat in one of the booths in the library and recorded this video. And everyone's obviously up watching me because they're like, what the hell is this guy doing? Like, you're talking to a camera. Are you a vlogger? Like, do you know what I mean? And so, yeah, just did the video myself. And just tried to tell the story as much as anything.
Mm-hmm.
Like the one thing that Movem had that I see a lot of companies don't have now is like a story.
Yeah.
So we were trying to help tenants, you know, get rid of the bad, nasty landlord, right? Was the story that we had at that time.
And it was a pain that you'd felt personally, yeah. You know, which is super important.
And everyone's felt that. And even landlords, you know, if you say like, you know, your son, daughter, they're like, oh yeah, their house is terrible, right? So it's like everyone can kind of get on board with it. And I was confident enough that you go in a room and you say to 30 people, like, this is the idea. Most of them will tell me that's a great idea.
Yeah.
The difficulty was just making that idea work as a business or work as a, you know, work in real life. But the idea was good. So, you do the video, you do a bit of text spiel, and then you're really alone with it. And they kind of give you a date. You know, you're going to go live on this date. You've got to raise, we had 120,000 to raise, and they gave us 30 days. So I'd lined up press releases for every 4 days, I think it was. And it was like news that I'd like pre-planned.
Mm.
So I was like, we're going to spill the beans on these areas. So the first one was something like, you know, we're now in 100 cities. We've hit that milestone. Just try and keep things ticking along. Because that's the problem. You see all these pitches that die and they lose momentum and then you really are screwed.
Yeah. So you had a whole kind of content calendar almost in advance, like to really try and keep the momentum going.
Well, I was lucky enough that I could live at home.
Mm-hmm.
So the bills were zero, basically. You know.
So almost infinite runway from your perspective.
So every year I have my accountancy, right?
Mm.
And like legal fees or whatever. And that was the upcoming bill. And I think that was like 6 months away. So I was like, I know, I don't take a wage anymore. I can just sit here and make this work. And I was like, I'll just make it work. I hadn't considered not. But the crowdfunding was the last ditch. If that didn't work, I would have given up, I think, if I'm honest with myself. But because I had so much time and I was pitching for so long to get that initial money, I literally studied every single crowdfunding pitch. Just because, like, not, I didn't sit down and consciously go, I'm going to study it.
Just
like,
watch all of them and absorbed what they were doing.
I just watched them because I was just, like, obsessed with the idea that no one will do it and I'll make myself look like an idiot. And that was my biggest fear, I think, was, like, I'll put it online, my friends will see it and they'll laugh at me because, like, no one invested and I'm there like, can I have some money?
You know. I can't have that happen.
Yeah, and I think that's probably everyone else's... I think that's probably quite a universal fear is, like, what if I put myself out there and...
You don't want to have a failed pitch, do you? No,
and it's quite a real fear because, like, most of them fail.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's not even like, just go with it, you'll be fine. It's like, yeah, if that failed, I would have been embarrassed.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's the right thing.
No, absolutely. I think that everyone could relate to that. You know, if you put yourself out there and you're making all of this kind of material, you want it to be a success, don't you? You don't want it to kind of get to the end and you're like 60% funded or whatever.
Yeah.
But when you go into it, I guess you know you've got that segment locked in that you've got the matched funding on, but you really don't know how far you're going to get with the rest.
Yeah.
And as far as like the platform itself, so Crowdcube, did they help with marketing? Like, did they
No, these guys don't help in that way.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like both round one and two, they don't help. They, you know, I've got a lot of time for Crowdcube because obviously they helped us by default having a platform, but they don't go into it. Like they give you like a pack that's like, this is your crowdfunding pack. This will teach you everything you need to know, in inverted commas. But it's pretty poor. Like you can't prepare yourself for what is going to happen because like you look at the Monzos and you go, well, maybe in a day I'll be fully funded. And then you look at the other ones, you're like, well, maybe I'll never fund. It's somewhere in the middle. It depends on who you get.
You've got to put the work in, basically. You can't just assume to put a pitch up on there and like get instantly funded. It is still as much work as pitching traditional investors.
Yeah, but they do say a few things. Like they say, keep the discussions going. remain polite. It's a crazy one. I saw so many pictures of founders getting really arsy.
Really?
Like, people would ask questions like, I don't feel like you've got a business model. And then they would just get really arsy and there'd be super arguments. And you think, like, this isn't, you're not looking good.
Yeah, right? Yeah, from a PR perspective alone.
Yeah, so, you know.
So you went through that process, though, and you did successfully raise those two rounds.
Yeah.
So what did they come out at the end?
So the first one was 200,000.
Mm-hmm.
Funny story about that. When so Seeders is slightly different. You pay the money up front.
Yeah.
So you go, I'm going to invest £100 or whatever. You pay £100 and it sits in an escrow account. So the money is there. On Crowdcube, you don't pay until the end. But on both of them, you can pull out.
Mm.
Or at least you could at the time I did it, right? So what happened to me was, we raised one big shot investor came in like 10 days into the pitch. We'd raised 40,000, 50,000. Some big shot investor came in and put 80,000 in, right? I had a phone call with him. He was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. I'll put 80,000 in. So he does it. We complete the funding. I was like, wow, we did it in like 10 days or 11 days. Or then we were trying to collect the funds from everyone and he just went quiet. And he was like, yeah, I want to get a bit more information. So I went up to London a couple of times, you know, I shouldn't say who it is, but he was like the editor of quite a popular paper.
Okay.
So he's like, he knew it was a big shot. He took me to his big glass tower.
Oh, right, yeah.
Tried to intimidate me and said, I want it for less percentage.
Oh, right. That's not how it works.
And I was like, I can't actually do that.
No.
Like, even if I could, that's the deal. He strung me along for like a month and then dropped out. So then we had 120,000 of the stuff and he had just gone and whatever. Right, but then Crowdcube turn around, they say, look, we can't give you any of the money because if you didn't complete the round, you've got a day to find the rest.
Wow.
So I was like, right, the day to find 80,000 or you know, we lose it. And that was probably the worst time for us.
Yeah, because you've just gone through all that work and you feel like I've got somewhere. Yeah. And it's the like traditional startup thing, like the next day, oh no, I'm back to square one almost. Yeah, yeah. And it's panic mode. Yeah. So what happened?
Yeah, a Crowdcube don't let you go back on the platform. Right. They don't want pitches to go, oh yeah, this dropped out, so we're going to give it another day, never another 20 days.
Okay, yeah, because right? it looks bad.
It does look bad for them. And I can see why they do that. So we basically had a day to get the money, and then totally randomly, I was sat outside, you know, Mashtun?
Yeah.
Right, I sat outside there, and this guy from my old school walks past, and I was just like, oh, you're right, how's it going? And he's like, yeah, I'm fine. I saw your crowdfunding thing. I was like, oh yeah, no, it's, you know, went really well. And he's like, yeah, I was trying to get my dad to invest, but, like, you know, You completed it before I got a chance. And I was like, well, look, between you and me, someone might be looking to drop out. So if you're interested, I didn't really think much of it. And then, yeah, that guy calls me up later that evening and he didn't invest all of it. But he invested some. And then the rest of it I managed to find from other investors. But once I got like a chunk of that out of the way, I called up the biggest people who did it. And I was like, look, this is
what's happened.
This is what's happened. And then, yeah, luckily people pulled through and
so it's really perseverance and a bit of luck as well.
So much luck. So like there are three or four times throughout the whole thing where I can look and I go, I was just rolling a dice at that point, and you know, 9 out of 10 times that would have been it. And so yeah, it wasn't ability or talent or anything for those points, but.
But you kept going on it as well, because you could have just given up when that 80,000 was pulled out, and you'd be like, oh, this is impossible.
Yeah.
But like, to keep going with it, it's definitely a big credit, I think. So yeah. But I guess once you've come through this crowdfunding process, at this point the site's still a review site, isn't it? Basically, at what point does this decision to make this huge pivot come around and? And how does that happen?
Yeah, so we did the 200,000 and then we built the team, hired some people, really tried to hire like the right people.
And this is in the Brighton office. Brighton,
yeah. Yep. So we set up the one in the Old Steen. And then we spent some of that money, and what happened was, instead of being just like TripAdvisor, so students review agents, we tried to flip it a bit to be like, you'll create this passport profile thing. And at the time, the passport term hadn't been used, but now it's used everywhere for property. But at the time, it was like, tenants review there, landlords review the tenants, you have this traveling profile, you can move around houses, best tenants get the best properties, everyone wins, maybe then landlords will pay me money. Right, was the thing. So we had that, we ran out of money again, we didn't sell anything, so we had to go back to Crowdcube. This time I think we only had, we raised 400,000, I think, and I think we only had 90,000 of that pre-raised. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't much the second time.
And did you have a lot of, were they mostly investors who'd followed on from the previous round? Or
So we had 150 investors in the first one,
mm-hmm.
and then 500 in the second one. So we definitely had loads of new investors. But yeah, some of the biggest investors from the first round doubled down or put more in.
Nice.
Which is actually why the second round was so much easier,
mm-hmm.
because I'd done it once and we had, you know, 150 people who were like, well, I'll just put a tenner in to make the pitch look good because that's got my money in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, I want that to try and look good. So that really helped. But yeah, so then after we raised the second round, we just kind of in the office just like stumbled on the idea of a reference.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason it came about was, so for a tenant to move into a property, they have to go through a referencing process. And
which is horrible.
Yeah, like, which is
horrible. The old way of doing it is, if anyone's ever rented, you know how bad it is.
Yeah.
You've got to give over all of your kind of paper bank statements, pay hundreds of pounds. It takes days. Yeah. It's just a bit of a nightmare. So everyone's like...
Yeah, you print out, you send over your bank statement in a PDF. Somebody has it somewhere. They look at it. They... hopefully don't judge you. They
for like buying like 10 pints,
yeah,
on a phone.
Yeah. And anyway, so that process took 2 days or more sometimes. It could take 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So for this platform, and the reason why it bothered me was, imagine Airbnb, but when you go to rent somewhere, that's like, okay, well, your order's been requested, we'll let you know within 2 weeks. You're like, well, no, I want it now.
Yeah.
I want to know I've booked it. Otherwise, I'll just go on booking.com.
Yeah.
So... that was my thinking, was we had to solve this issue of like latency in the booking. So we basically, this guy Marcus, him and I just sat for like weeks and worked through how we could, and it was called like a not reference at the time. We were like, specifically, like, this isn't a reference, this is like an alternative to referencing. So the idea would be, landlords agree to not do a reference if they use our service, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, we just kind of put some pieces together. And then in doing that, we realized that was like really good.
Yeah, and you actually got some really interesting pieces together. Like, I think there's how you got the credit bureau data and open banking,
yeah.
All those kind of things were coming together at this time to make this possible.
Yeah.
So
that was it. We had a few bits of new technology. So this was before open banking, but there was like older banking APIs.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just thought that you can look in someone's bank account and then we'll try and find income and rent and we'll just do it from there, right? Anyway, it was never like a big thing. It was a small part of the puzzle. But then as we were talking to more agencies, this was the bit they liked. And so we literally ended the crowdfunding round. And then a few weeks later, I basically did the only Steve Jobs-esque move I've ever done, which is like, we're doing this and I'm sorry, but we're killing the thing you invested in. This is a much better
idea.
We're
going all in.
You've got to trust me.
Yeah. And you're not just doing this with like one or two investors. You've got to communicate this with hundreds of investors. So so how did you do that?
I tell you what, I had an easy run because most of them, like, there was probably out of the... I don't know, maybe 600 unique investors or 700, so there's something around those lines. That was probably only 10 that ever bothered responding to me. And I did all these email, like every month I'd do an update and it'd be like, this is what we've done, this is how we're growing, yada, yada, yada. And like, no one would ever respond. And I'd look at the click-throughs and most people wouldn't bother clicking on the links I sent, but I still did it.
Mm-hmm.
So when I gave the dictatorship, we're changing course, because trust me, this is way better. Like I did know at that point that what we had done is way better. And we just made, yeah, we made the decision quickly, just told everyone what's happening. And I think I only had like 10 people call me up, but you know, and to be honest, most of them were like, well, we trust you, just do what you think's best. I think everyone was really nice, actually, to be honest.
So you, like, everyone's super supportive.
Yeah. No, if someone had been like, no, you're doing the old thing, I'm going to sue you, I don't know what I would have done.
Because you really believed that this was the way to go. And it was it like a, how would you describe it as like a gut thing, or that you looked at the data from, you know, these conversations with agents, or was it just a combination of everything that made you make this massive decision?
The old one wasn't working, and I'd spent a lot of money. So at that point, we had spent maybe £400,000 chasing that idea.
Of the review site,
and
that
seen
vision.
No progress. And I'd really tried with that, and the guys had really tried as well. And I think we had some smart people involved at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And they couldn't make it work. So I was like, look, it isn't just me. We're all struggling to work out how to do this. So this new thing came along, and it just kind of clicked. And it was like, we found that people were saying, when can they buy it? Which to me was like,
this is a really good sign.
Yeah. What we've done before is we had people interested in the story, but no one wanted to buy it.
Mm.
Weirdly, with the new one, I don't feel like we had the story, but people wanted to buy it. So that was like 2 years before we ended up selling, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe a year and three quarters. But at the time, it felt like an obvious decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. Looking back, I can't remember the point, but it felt very obvious at the time.
So you go through this whole kind of transition, and you put this new product together in this completely new kind of proposition that you've got. How does it go? How does it go down with the market? Does it get traction as though you thought it would?
So we initially built it inside of the code of what we had before, which was like the right decision at the time, but like really bogged everything down.
Mm-hmm. So you were building on top of your old review platform.
So it was
basically
a real mess. Mm-hmm. And then we had a real, like, you know, we had a real problem with identity and like working out what went wrong, and you know, everyone chipped in at that point to like try and solve that problem. Mm. Like I couldn't see through it on my own. I, you know, all the guys in the office kind of came together, and I think over the course of like, I don't know, 6 months, worked out how to chip away the old stuff. And people, I can't remember how many people bought it. We had like 20 agents who signed up at one point. And then I think only three of them ended up using it properly.
Mm-hmm.
But by that point, we were having talks with like a few companies to buy us or invest in us or whatever. So
those conversations had already started. And you also had, I think an interesting thing that happened then is it wasn't just agents who were becoming customers. It was other kind of prop tech companies who wanted to use it through an API, which was a new thing, wasn't it?
Well, this is the thing. So we went from review site for tenants to a product for agencies to reference their tenants quicker, to actually agencies are really slow and they don't want to sign up to new stuff. They hate new stuff, and prop tech is a really like bad industry for like new technology because there aren't early adopters, or at least not very many. So what we did was we made an API that let other prop tech companies build in our functionality, and then the idea was I don't have to sell to agents.
Yeah,
like, I can just sell to people like me and like you who understand how tech works, and that felt like an easier sell, and that was a much easier sell. And then we got, within the first like 2 months, I think we had like 100,000 orders of references. Like they didn't pay up front, but I think we had that many. It was quite a lot.
So suddenly you'd got this much quicker kind of route to market by partnering with other companies who already had these complicated and hard to get relationships with agents. You kind of almost started to bypass that and just go direct to them really, and provide them with a service just through an API rather than going direct to agents yourself, which I, like you were saying, is really expensive to acquire them as customers, and they're you know, it's pretty hard work as well.
And the SaaS product worked a lot better for what we were doing. Like the tech work we were doing, I don't know if it was hard tech, but putting all the quite easy pieces together was quite challenging. And especially looking in people's bank accounts and trying to work out what is income. It's a very difficult answer. It's like, there's a really difficult question to answer. So it took us, it probably took us like 18 months to even get a version working that was like remotely useful.
So in a way, that's a good thing as well, because it's kind of defensive if it's taken you that long to put it together and it's a brand new thing that hasn't existed before. You know, other people would be having those same challenges, and if you're the first onto market with it, that's...
Well, we started doing that. I don't know. So one of the guys will be able to call me out on this, but I feel like we started maybe like 2016.
Okay.
Doing that. Like, Marcus and I first started ages before, and we had the first versions going quite early. And I still don't think anyone's beaten what we made in maybe 2018, right? Like, when I use the Cool Credit version, who are this massive agency, a bit like Experian, I've seen their version of it, and it was way worse.
Yeah.
So, like, we didn't have anything to compare to when we were building it. So we would put out a version or you know, release some code, and we'd be like, it doesn't work, it's buggy.
Yeah.
And that plagued us for however long, probably the whole time, actually. But I think in that we're making pretty good progress. But
absolutely.
Yeah, it was... Yeah.
So
just thinking back to all the hardship.
Yeah, oh no, don't want to think about it. So, but you've been having these conversations with a few people then who are saying, we're liking this new direction, we might want to put some money in, maybe even some initial conversations about an acquisition.
Yeah.
So you were eventually acquired by the market leader of traditional referencing, right? So how did that happen, and how long did it take?
Yeah. Was it a Hollywood story?
Yes.
Well, some elements of it were... The acquisition was actually a good deal for everyone, and I knew that. And so one of the things, obviously, I can't say too much about the process or the conversations, but broadly, we approached them. I was talking to their competitors about a partnership, and one of them in particular we got quite far down the road with. And then I was like, you know what? I should see what they're doing, because that's a fairly good, you know, like, see what else is happening in the market. And then weirdly, they got in touch with me before I had a chance to get in touch with them. I met them, and I think the first time I met them, they admitted that they were just trying to get information out of me. Like, they never wanted a partnership. They were, and I know the guy that did it now quite well, and I really like him, and he was honest with me, and he said, look, we were just trying to see what you're about, right? Maybe not copy me, but gauge if you're worth talking to.
Put the feelers out.
And then that was like a year before they ended up buying us. Because what happened was, they talked to us, they realised that we were about to partner with their competitors. And we had this piece of tech that would have taken them years to build. These companies, they don't have tech teams in the same way they have IT departments, or they have a tech team. Like, Homelit does have a tech team.
It's not a software company.
It's not a software company. Yeah. And they would be the first to admit it, and they've got big technical debt in a bunch of areas, or perhaps they're working on new projects, or whatever, like every big company does have, right? You know, it's nothing specific to them. And then, so they couldn't really afford the time or whatever to start doing what we had already done. They didn't want to be behind. We were talking to our competitors. And so, yeah, we looked at, I went up to meet them like quite a few times. And each time, for the first few, we had just discussed working together.
Yeah.
And then as we had those conversations, I always wanted to be acquired, obviously, right?
Yeah.
But I couldn't just push for it. But as we had those conversations, they started to realize that actually a partnership's quite costly for them. Like, they will take us, give us a bunch of like users basically, and we'll make a nice sweet profit out of that. And the cost to them, they're not making a huge amount because they're still paying for it. Whereas if they bought us, they might recoup the costs in a few years. They do their own thing with it, right? So there was no single point where it like flipped, and there was no Hollywood like slide a napkin across a table with a figure on it. It was more conversational over such a long time that it was like, I got to know the guys, they got to know me. We all had like a mutual respect for like where our, you know, strengths and weaknesses were, and then it kind of naturally came to the point where we were all like, well, maybe this is something we should seriously look at. We did. And obviously that whole time I thought it was going to fall through, right?
Yeah.
And up until the day it happened, I thought it was.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was so progressive.
It wasn't like overnight kind of thing.
No, it wasn't, no.
But I think one interesting element of it is obviously you're not, when you're going through this acquisition, you're not kind of dealing with, again, like one or two investors. You've got 600-700 people to take along with you on this. And the admin that comes along with that.
Mm.
So that's quite interesting because I don't think this is something that's explored that often. Yeah. It's like, how does a crowdfunded company exit and what is involved? Because it sounds like a nightmare. Yeah.
The administrative task of that was hell. Like, I mean that. So when you sell, you know what, I can't speak for every company you sell, but when we sold, what we had to do is we had a bunch of forms. We did a drag along, right? Which is where, because the crowdfunders had under a certain amount and I already had the big ones agreeing to it previously, we had a drag along, which meant they didn't have to sign it. They were selling their shares regardless.
Yeah.
So even if they said, I don't want to sell, but legally we still had to give them the chance to refuse it or whatever. And we also had to collect bank details and because, oh yeah, that's the big thing. CrowdCube do not give you money back, right? So I thought the CrowdCube would invest the money, send it to my bank. When we sell, I'll send CrowdCube, whatever, 100 grand.
Yeah, right? And they'll send it out to everyone.
Between
yeah.
the people that they need to. But no, they don't do that. So you're all on your own. So I recruited my girlfriend, my mum, my brother, and someone else, five of us. Who was the last person? I think my sister came for a bit. Anyway.
So like a family day of paperwork.
I daisy chained five printers together, printing out this paper. In hindsight, I should have just printed it out of shop, right? But at the time, I didn't realise how big the task was. But I ended up printing, it was like 300,000 pieces of paper or something.
So for each shareholder,
yeah,
there's
each
like...
each shareholder, it was like 100 sheets of paper.
It's insane.
Or something crazy like that. So I did it all day and until like 5 in the morning, maybe 4 in the morning. And the next day I'd do it from like 9 a.m, wouldn't sleep. Because that's the other thing, I had a time limit. I had to get all this paper out by Friday. And I found out I had to do it on Monday or something silly, right? So yeah, I was just... That bit actually would make a really funny comedy sketch or like a movie, because I was up putting these things in envelopes, losing other bits of paper, putting stamps on them, and we had like a like a factory doing all this stuff, and we only got it to the post office with like 15 minutes to spare in the end.
Wow.
Like, it was crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, you had to get all the signatures, you had to sign everything. I had to sign 10 bits of paper in every single envelope by hand.
It's crazy, isn't it? Absolutely nuts.
But
so, you got through it, and
Deal closes. Yeah, I had to go to London and sign. So I had to sign the thing that I'd signed and sent to investors. The ones that didn't reply, which were 99% of them, I had to reprint out and do again.
Oh.
Right. So, but this time I paid a legal firm to do it for me, and they had four of their interns printing and signing round the clock, right? So I went to their offices, and from like the morning, and this was the morning the deal closed, right? Because, oh no, the morning before the deal closed, right? It was 9 a.m, and the plan was I'll be there all day. These girls will take out the right one, put it in front of me, I'll sign. They'll put it in the envelope, sort the envelope.
It's like a production line of paperwork.
Like, literally like I'd done with like myself at home, but like way more organized. Like, these people were on it. Right? Yeah. I really knew what they were doing.
It's not in your front room.
Yeah, it wasn't in the front room. And I had to sign, and it got to like 11 o'clock at night, and I bought everyone dinner because like they were staying late.
Mm.
And then they were like, you're going to have to come in tomorrow morning. So I had to book a hotel, like the only hotel I could find nearby, stay overnight, be there for 9 a.m. and do another day of signing. So it took me 2 days, just sat at a desk signing my name. Yeah, and then after that, the deal had closed.
And it was finally done.
Yeah, and then they did the press release. And
so, kind of, you've carried on with that for a while, and then I guess you're starting to think about what next at that point.
Yeah, so the plan was, always to look at these two products and work out how they can, like, exist together.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened over the next kind of from September 2018 to about June this year was we looked at how these two companies could exist, and we realized that although there is space for both of them, the tech inside Moovem is actually way better inside Homelet, which is mm-hmm. one of their brands.
Mm-hmm.
They've got like huge distribution, they've got like the staff and even some internal kind of benefits to their system that meant that us rebuilding a lot of stuff wasn't possibly the right thing to do. But yeah, you know, by kind of June this year, I had done the handover, I had seen everything through. My skills were largely not necessary anymore
mm-hmm.
because they've, you know, they've got a big exec team who are in their individual fields really good at what they do.
Yeah.
And so my broad, you know, I'm okay at a lot of stuff approach wasn't that necessary anymore.
Mm-hmm.
But so yeah, we kind of mutually agreed that I'd step away.
Yeah, it's a traditional thing that happens. You know, you kind of have a good few months helping with integration, and then I guess at that point you're thinking about like what's the next idea. You've probably got hundreds bubbling away, and you're starting to get eager about working on some of them.
Yeah, I'm definitely eager to do something else. Not sure entirely what yet. There are a few things that, like, a few people have, you know, approached me with ideas or whatever, and so yeah, they're interesting, but I'm not sure what the...
It's a big commitment, as you've just seen, like going through this huge emotional journey, you know, years long.
Yeah.
Whatever you pick, you've got to be like confident it's something you want to really work on.
I tell you what's funny, that the loss after selling a company is enormous.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, you can't describe it. And I heard that in Silicon Valley, right, they give people free counselling.
Because it's had so your traumatic. Life dominated by this thing, and then suddenly overnight it's gone and taken away, and like what so you're like feeling, oh, well, what do I do now?
Yeah, it's just boredom. Like I was so used to, you know, and I don't expect sympathy from anyone.
No, yeah.
But I was so used to, for 6.5 years, maybe even 7 years, you know, so all I thought about was this one thing.
Mm.
So to then not think about that anymore is like so much free time to do other stuff. So I'm very eager to like do it again, because I think there's nothing quite...
It's addictive.
There's nothing quite like it, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that's... I think that sounds like it's been like a really exciting journey that you've been on with it.
Mm.
So I'm super excited to see what you turn your hand to next. I think it'll be really interesting.
We might end up doing something together.
I think so, yeah. You never say never, do you? It's,
no.
It's always funny to...
It's a matter of when.
Yeah. So, like, there's one question that we are going to ask everyone on the... like a final question, like a bit of a bookend that we're asking everyone. So obviously we're focused on highlighting all these cool companies like yours in Brighton and Sussex that have done so well. So we're just asking everyone, what is one company in this area that's doing something that's interesting that you're kind of following?
So there is one. There's this startup in New Haven that is trying to develop the blackest black material.
Is that cool? It's got a name, isn't it?
It's called like Vanta Black.
That's it, right? Yeah.
And they're super interesting. Like, they're not this traditional startup in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
So, probably different to the other answers you'll get.
No, but it's good to hear about all kinds of companies.
They're trying to develop a black material that absorbs most of the light.
Because
if a black is true black, you won't be able to see outlines of it. So like a black iPhone.
Absorbs everything.
It would
everything.
Just be a gap in space. Yeah, so that's probably the one that's interested me the most.
Nice. Cool. Yeah. Well, I think thanks for so much for coming on, because that was it was fascinating to hear your story. A really interesting...
thanks for having me.
...adventure. Yeah, no, and definitely. And we'll definitely keep following you and everything you're doing, and we'll keep you on the blog, and hopefully we'll see you at some of the events.
Yeah. No, I'd love to.
Definitely. So, just as a reminder, we have a coffee morning every second Thursday of the month. So don't forget to sign up at sussexfounders.com for the mailing list, and you'll get like an email saying when the next one is. But other than that, thanks so much to Pete for joining us, and we'll see you soon.
Cheers. See ya.